This episode is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program.
Hello, you are tuned into Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Musqueam people at UBC. My name is Alirad Amari, and I'm joined by my co-host today, Gurman Gill. Each week on Research Review, we interview a researcher who is affiliated with the UBC community and discuss some of their latest work and findings and how they relate to broader issues in society. We would like to welcome Dr. Tamara Vanderwall to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. Dr. Vanderwall is an assistant professor at UBC's Department of Psychiatry, as well as a clinical researcher and child psychiatrist at BC Children's Hospital. So that's all correct?
That is all correct.
Excellent.
You got it right.
So yes, you know, start off with the first question, the one that we generally ask everyone. What precede you to follow this field, like, you know, early on as undergrad, like, how did you go down this path?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I was like on the path, but not knowing I was on the path for a long time. So even when I was in high school, I did this thing called the National Research Science Institute or something. So like I spent a summer out in a forest in Ontario studying like forest fires burning into the ground and how we measure the effect on different layers of the forest floor. And all the time I'm doing this, I know, it's super cool, right?
It's kind of the stuff that I like.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So all the time I was doing things like that, I was on the road to going to medical school because I wanted to be a doctor. Mm-hmm. And all through undergrad, I would end up doing these like crazy thesis projects. And just sort of asking questions wherever I went. Then went to medical school, and the med school I went to has a thesis requirement, which is quite unique. And so you can take an optional year to do a year of research, which I was pretty keen to do, and did my first neuroimaging study. And since then was just pretty geeked out by the ability to like look at the brain and to visualize these functional patterns. I really like the visual parts of it too. So it was a neat combo for me. So from then on out, it was mostly about, like, I chose my residency based on my interest in research.
Mm-hmm. So I guess, like, you know, when you were in medical school, that's when you really started to think more about the research side of thing, right?
Yeah. And just to realize that that's what I've been interested in the whole time. Like, oh, not everybody has 57 questions that they want to ask of the thing. Like, oh, okay.
That's pretty interesting. And I guess right now you practice in child psychiatry as well, right?
Yeah. So I do that about a day a week. Mm-hmm. And then I run my lab the other 4 days a week.
Pretty interesting. Is there any overlap between the like your practice and sort of the research that you do?
Yeah. I think there's a ton. I'm a pretty clinical researcher. Like, we do some highfalutin stuff, but there's always like a clinical application or a clinical question, mm-hmm. you know, seven steps behind it. But yeah, so for me, it's always been very frustrating as a psychiatrist that we practice so differently than other doctors, mm-hmm. right? If you bring your kid to see me, I don't go and order like four tests and interpret them and come up with a, you know, probable diagnosis and a treatment plan based on those tests. Mm-hmm. There's no tests. We don't diagnose like that, and we don't treat like that. Which is really frustrating. It's frustrating for me. It's frustrating for kids and their families. And so that's really what I think kind of motivates the work and also mm-hmm. frames the questions, right? Like, it's nice to be a doctor and know, oh, a test would be really, we don't need a test for every single case mm-hmm. or for every single kid, but there's certain ones where it would make a huge difference. And so, yeah, that informs kind of how I think about the brain and how I think about like what are the important questions to be asking and where, what would be the end game? Where do we want to end up?
Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, a lot of your research revolves around fMRI technology. So yep. MRI, I guess, standing for magnetic resonance imagery, right?
Yeah, magnetic resonance imaging.
What does the F stand for?
Functional.
Functional.
Okay. Yeah, it's the fancy part. I call it fancy. So typically, you know, you've seen, most people have seen an MRI of some part of the body, right? You can do an MRI of the knee if you hurt your knee playing soccer or whatever. And right in those cases, you're looking at structure, right? It looks like a picture of the inside of your knee or your head. So that's the normal kind of more straightforward structural MRI stuff. The functional is when we're looking to see which parts of the brain are active. And so we do that in kind of an inferential way. It's a little bit like, it's not directly looking at what neurons are active. It's actually looking at the blood flow changes. But so we can do that with the same machine with the MRI. And when we're doing that in the brain, we call it an fMRI or functional MRI.
Yeah, a lot of your research revolves around this concept of functional connectivity. So could you explain to the viewers what that means?
Yeah, super cool. So we didn't know about it. Like, I don't know, 20 years ago, nobody knew that this thing existed. Basically what it is looking at what parts of the brain, even if they're in two different, so one part could be at the front of your head and one part could be at the back of your head. And you're looking to see if the blood flow changes in those two separate regions are going like up and down together, right? So that sounds sort of basic, but what's really cool, one, we didn't know it did that. And two, when you look at those patterns of connections or of correlations, they pattern out into these networks. And these networks, we all have them and they're active all the time, even if you're just chilling out doing nothing, right? And so this added this whole new level of organization in the functional architecture of the brain that we could then study, right? So that was like a really massive discovery. And now all of these, they're either called resting state or functional connectivity studies are happening, you know, and it comprises now probably, I don't know, at least half the field.
Yeah, you mentioned resting state fMRI. I also heard the term task-based. Is there a difference between the two? Or are you familiar with?
No, I know, like, I'm going to have to look that one up. That sounds...
I know like some kids have to do like tasks in the MRI machine or something like that.
Yeah. Oh, task space. Is that what you said? Task space?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you can measure the functional changes in the brain. The oldest way of doing that is with tasks, right? So somebody will be looking at houses and looking at faces, and we can see which parts of the brain are responding to each of those things. So that would be like a task experiment. Then the resting state came on, right? The cool thing about resting state is they don't have to do a task. They can just lay there. And then we can look at that resting state business, those networks that I was just talking about. So those are like the two kind of basic ways of doing that stuff. In my lab and in quite a few labs, we actually use movies instead. So I want to look at those functional connectivity patterns, but I want to look at them when you're really using your brain and you're using like a whole bunch of your brain, not just the parts that look at houses or faces. I want the parts like when you're having to do eight things at once and track conversation and listen to music and changing perspective. And, you know, I want like the active brain.
Yeah, I would assume like listening to movies would be a lot easier for kids with like developmental delay or like cognitive delay than like doing task-based work in an MRI.
For sure. Also, tasks are just boring. Anyone who's done, like the tasks we make are kind of hilarious, right? It's like press a button when the arrow points to the right. And now please do that for the next 20 minutes, right? It's like not super interesting. And like, I think you start doing other stuff with the rest of your brain 10 minutes into that run. So it's not a great way to query. It's really good for certain things for sure. But so it's good for kids to help them stay still. And it's also just good to drive multiple networks at once if that's what you're interested in.
So what kind of ages of kids are you usually looking at? Because I would assume, like, I know from my own experience, like, kids, like, 6 and younger are just terrified of the MRI, and anxiety in the MRI is pretty high.
Yeah, and even if they're super excited, like, some of them get geeked out about it too, right? They're very excited about being in the scanner, or they, like science and they want to see their brains or whatever. As soon as they're under the age of 7, they just move too much in general. Like, it takes a pretty, like, some of them can do it, but it's only a handful, right? They just, kids move a lot. Like, it's a natural part of their developmental stage. And they move a ton when they're in the magnet, to the degree that it's only been in the last 5 years, I would say, that we've actually been able to even study these functional connectivity relationships in kids that little. And the only way we've been able to do that at scale, like with decent numbers of kids and for a long enough data collection time, is using movies.
Excellent. We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message, so please stay tuned.
Red Cat Records is an amazing artist-owned and operated record store. Shop from their diverse online music collection and get free shipping within Vancouver and the Lower Mainland with the purchase of 2 or more LPs. If you would like to further support them through the evolving COVID-19 crisis, you can do so by buying a gift card to use at a later date. Visit www.redcat.ca for more information.
You are listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. Today we are interviewing Dr. Tamara Vanderwall, an assistant professor at UBC's Department of Psychiatry, as well as a clinical researcher and child psychiatrist at BC Children's Hospital. So far we've talked with Dr. Vanderwall a bit about her history, how she got interested in the field of psychiatry, and also a bit about fMRI technology. So, Gurman, I think he had something to ask.
Yeah. Let's talk about your work with movies. I know you've, like, when you started out, you had a lot of work on just looking at whether or not kids can, like, stay still while watching movies.
Right.
I know kids in general have trouble staying still, but I would assume it'd be even more difficult for kids with psychiatric conditions like ADHD.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny. I think that seems like the total natural thing. And, like, I've had parents tell me, like, oh no, my kid can't possibly have ADHD. He can stay still in front of the TV for like 2 hours. It's actually a pretty commonly held thing for those of us who see a bunch of kids, that kids with ADHD are remarkably still when they're in front of basically moving images, right? So if something is on the screen in front of them, providing that motion input, there's suddenly something happens in their like neurology, they're suddenly like able to be still. And it's so different than their normal baseline of activity that everyone's like, whoa. Mm-hmm. So it is very, very helpful. And I came up with this idea, actually, I can't even remember, but like my niece and my nephew were, you know, messing around, they're little kids and jumping all over everything. And then someone turns the TV on and they just turn towards it. And like, they're like mid movement. So they're like super awkward, right? Not comfortable, but they're entranced and they're all of a sudden still like statues, right? And kids just do this. It's a really remarkable effect, right? I always joke that every minivan maker in the world knows this, because like you can't buy a minivan without, you know, a screen in it. That's just like a given. If you're going to try to travel with kids these days, you're going to put a screen in front of their face. And it's I think it's because of this effect, which we've now borrowed and used inside the MRI magnet.
And I guess, you know, one question I have in your research, does what is like playing on the screen, what is playing on the TV, does that have any impact on the response?
Yeah, it has a really big impact on it. So we started this work only trying to go after that behavioral effect, right? That stillness. And then rapidly became more interested in what's the movie doing to the brain, right? So the first movie we made, and we decided we needed to make our own because it was going to be something that didn't exist out there, right? We weren't just going to show like Finding Nemo or whatever. because we wanted something that was going to be more like these resting state scans that the adults were doing. We didn't want kids to be verbally processing. We didn't want kids to be doing tons of social processing. So we decided we had to make this movie. So the movie's called InScapes. It's online and you can look it up if you want to. And it's basically, I get really mad when people say this, but it's like a screensaver. It's a really expensive screensaver. And we actually made it really carefully. We made it with professional artists. It has an original score that was written to kind of work with the sounds that the magnet itself makes, right? Because the magnet is loud. Mm-hmm. And we made all sorts of careful decisions about making it developmentally appropriate and having it look really cool while you're inside the scanner. So we like really took it on as sort of an art project and came up with a 7-minute movie that's meant to be like rest, but to let you stay still, right? It's kind of walking that fine line in the middle. And it matters. It makes a difference. It doesn't drive those functional connectivity patterns in the same way that regular movies do, right? So yeah, it's a big question in the field right now. Like, what movie should we be showing for what purposes? And it's pretty funny to see what people choose for their different things. And everyone gets very passionate about their choice, right?
Yeah, I know movies are pretty common in the MRI-PC children's these days. Pretty much like any kid that goes into the MRI can just watch Frozen whenever they want. I think that was the main one when I worked there, was what everyone was choosing.
For sure. When we were piloting InScapes, the thing I was just talking about, I always ask kids after they watch it, what did you like? What did you not like? Blah, blah, blah. And about halfway through, and I always ask them what their favorite color is, because I don't know. So halfway through, all of a sudden, everyone starts telling me that their favorite color is powder blue. And I'm like, what on earth is going on? And it was right when Frozen had come out. And so all of the little kids were all changing their favorite color based on, so yes, these are culturally informed things.
And I know recently you've been looking at other applications of the movies, to evoke, I guess you would call it clinical symptoms in patients. Could you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. So with InScapes, we were kind of going for this resting state baseline thing, right? And with this, now we're starting to go more clinical, which is where I always wanted to go, and to look at different disorders. And the first one that we're working on is childhood onset OCD or obsessive compulsive disorder, which is a pretty big deal. It's a pretty severe diagnosis. It's worse generally than adult onset OCD. And I always think we kind of think we know what OCD is, right? In the general culture, we're always joking about, oh yeah, that's my OCD or whatever. But anyways, it's a pretty, it's a big deal diagnosis, especially for a kid. And what's really interesting is that the diversity in symptoms across kids can be super impressive. So one kid could be super freaked out by germs and contamination and stuff. And another kid who has it can be freaked out by something totally different, but they both have OCD, right? And even if you have two kids who say they have contamination issues, one of them could hate touching a doorknob, right? And one of them, a doorknob could be fine. So where does that leave me as a scientist wanting to study these symptoms? How do I figure out what the brain is doing when everyone's evoked by different symptoms, right? It's a problem. So, and people have come up with all these crazy ways of trying to study this. Our crazy way of trying to study this is to make a movie of all of these different scenes and all of these different symptom domains and try to create this sort of cinematic experience that will evoke these symptoms for all of these different kids. So it's the first live action movie that we've made. We made it here in Vancouver, which is a great place to be doing this kind of work, right? We filmed it right before the pandemic started, so we were super, super lucky. And we've now got funding to study it, to use it in a couple studies. So we're just about to start data collection for for this new movie. It's called All Day Wrong.
Yeah, I know in one of your papers you sort of compared it to like a cardiac stress test, where like you may not be able to see the symptoms just regularly, but if you like push them, you sort of like get that those symptoms start to like be made clear, and that's pretty common in like cardiac tests. But
yeah, you reveal the deficit, right? And yeah, it's totally like that. I think one of the things in neuroscience that's been hard, and you guys probably know this from some of your classes, but like the brain is so complex, and trying to describe what it does is like has proven basically impossible. My way around that as a lowly MD is I don't really care. I just want a good way of studying the functioning organ. Right. So I just need something to show me where the problem is. And I just need to drive the organ and watch it work and measure it in a reliable way. Right. So I think my job in that sense is easier than people who are trying to like truly understand from a neuroscience perspective, you know, how does this computational process occur?
Great. We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message.
Every Friday at noon, CITR takes you on a journey through Thunderbird Radioland. A journey of sound and song, of words and music, of the now and then, of the right here and the far away. It's the Eclectic Lunch, every Friday at 12 noon on Thunderbird Radio, 101.9 FM in beautiful Vancouver.
You are listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, and today we are interviewing Dr. Tamara Vanderwall. And so far we've talked a bit about a method of having children undergoing MRI scans watch movies during the scan. So, Grimon, I think you had something to ask.
Yeah, I would assume that evoking clinical symptoms with some conditions might be a bit tricky, especially in an MRI where it's like, you don't, like, for example, like an anxiety disorder, you would not want that in an MRI.
You don't really want to study that in the magnet, per se. Yes.
Yeah. So what sort of conditions are you looking at, and which ones are you trying to avoid?
So one thing that I think is really cool about using movies is that you can go after these sort of higher order, more human processes. Right, like most of the stuff that my patients struggle with are like really like high level stuff. It's like depression is like massive, right? You have this sense of melancholy, you have this like loss of pleasure in things, right? Or in say something like a psychotic disorder, right? You have this intense sense of paranoia or like self-referential. Everything seems to like kind of point to you. I can't think of a task, right? Like of a basic scientific conventional task that can evoke that kind of thing. But I can totally think of how to make a movie to try to get some of those like more higher level or zeitgeist feel, you know what I mean? Like just these, like that sort of extra that film can do. So I don't know that there's any that I'm trying to avoid. I would just think you have to think of ways to do it that are, you know, one, ethically okay, and two, that are okay to study. But the other thing is most patients deal with this stuff every flipping day, right? Like this is their reality. They're not as scared of having their symptoms evoked, I think, as other people think they should. You know, they're like, oh my gosh, you're going to do that to a patient? And patients are like, yeah, what do you think I deal with every day?
Yeah, that's a good point. When I sort of imagine like evoking clinical symptoms in a patient, my first thought is, oh, they're going to have a freak out in the MRI machine. But you make a good point that this is stuff they deal with every day, and this is pretty much stuff they're used to already.
Yeah. And again, we do it with some sort of compassionate clinical idea. I don't want to like put them over the top because I'm not super interested in, you know, then they're just flight like freaking out, and I don't want to study that either. I want to study the underlying, just normal everyday stuff. So for example, in the OCD movie, we didn't want to go over the top. Like, they're very subtle scenes. It like gestures towards the thing, but it's not graphic. It's not like, you know, we're just trying to, it, you want it to like discriminate between people who have OCD and people who don't. And so it's actually pretty, pretty subtle. Nothing's like majorly scary or anything.
Yeah. Going back a little bit, what methods did you guys use to keep kids still before movies were a thing? Like, I guess anti-anxiety meds would probably be used pretty often.
Yeah. So you could like zonk kids out a bit, right? That's very, very effective. Sleeping, like kids under two, we have lots of data on, because you can like feed them, swaddle them, and put them in the magnet and just study them while they're sleeping. That works great. For awake kids, you know, people have been showing movies for like structural scans for a long time, help them stay still. But there's also like all these crazy physical devices. So you like pack foam padding around their heads. You put like masking tape across their forehead. There's a cool new company right now where they do these custom printed full head cases. So like you'd come in and we'd like take pictures of your whole head and we'd send that off to them and they would custom sculpt a huge head case, send it back to us, and we'd put you that on you and stick you in the magnet and then do the scan. It's a little expensive. And kids don't, I don't think kids love it just because it's like, it looks like a huge Darth Vader mask. Like, it's a big thing. So I like movies because it's more like, okay, nothing's touching you. You're okay.
Yeah. I know when I worked with, NBC Children's, like the MRI department always had an anesthesiologist on hand because there were a couple kids you had to like sedate or anesthetize.
Yeah.
I'm guessing
clinical scans, you can totally do that, right? Because you need that information to mm-hmm. help that kid. We would never do that for a research scan just because the risk for the kid is too great, right? For the benefit that it would give to science or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, theoretically, could you look at functional connectivity while the kid's anesthetized?
You could, yeah, and people have, and so it does funky things, right? So like even during sleep, the functional connectivity of those networks is really interesting. Like some of them break up in really cool ways. I don't know, people have looked at it with all sorts of different substances and different states of consciousness. But I don't do that. I just stick with movies.
You know, I had something to ask for one more, because you mentioned the headcase thing, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's pretty interesting because I'm guessing, you know, I've seen it in movies a few times where this thing is portrayed basically where they, you know, put something on a guy's head, hook it up with all the wires, and, you know, as someone's like feeling different emotions, you know, they see on the machine, they're like, oh, you know, like this guy's like feeling sad right now. Would you say that is an accurate portrayal of... No.
No. I think the portrayals of brain imaging on in Hollywood and on TV are quite humorous. Like, I remember one from House. I don't know if you guys ever saw mm-hmm. that show. Really cool. I think Dave Matthews was in the episode and he was like a savant or something. I don't know. They do an fMRI scan. And it's like in real time, they're seeing that the functional data on this guy's brain and they're saying like what it means. And we're all killing ourselves laughing because we're geeks and we think that that's funny. But because it would take like 2 days to process all that data and to actually see a functional thing, right? Like they were showing it. So yeah, I don't know.
You know, it's funny.
You can do real-time fMRI mm-hmm. now. You couldn't at the time when that episode came out. But we're getting closer to that picture that you're talking about, but we're certainly not there yet.
You know, it's funny. There's this movie filmed in 2014 called Hector and the Search for Happiness. Have you heard of that?
I have not.
You've not. It's pretty interesting because it was actually filmed at UBC as well. Parts of it in the Faculty of Medicine building as well, the Life Sciences Center. So if you have a chance, take a look at that, because there's one scene near the end. Not too familiar with the plot, but basically, there's a professor played by, Christopher Plummer, by the way, who, at the end uses this, brain scanning technology, not too sure about it exactly, but you know, it's like hooked up to the main character. And as this guy's like going through all sorts of emotions in real time, it's on a computer screen. And it's like, oh, this part of the brain, like right now is blue. Like you're feeling sad. Now you're feeling like angry. And, you know, I guess that's probably not how it works, is it?
I mean, it sounds more like EEG than fMRI, mm-hmm. but no EEG person would sit there and tell you like what you were feeling based on what they were seeing. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of funny that we all, I don't know, that's been like a long-term theme in movies, right? That there would be something that would like let us see inside the brain mm-hmm. and understand in real time. I think most therapists would be like, yeah, that's what therapy is for, right? Mm-hmm. Like we do that in interactions. We don't need a fancy machine for it. Too funny.
Yeah, I know medicine and TVs and movies always annoy me too. Like we were talking about House earlier, and I always found it funny how like the same three guys would perform all the surgeries and they would do all the MRI tests. There was no radiologist or MRI tech ever. They were just like all powerful doctors.
But they were multivalent. They did like 18 residencies. Yeah, that was not exactly realistic. I totally agree.
Yeah, no, I kind of like when I was growing up, I fell in love with ER though. And from my understanding, that was slightly more accurate.
That was a classic for sure.
Yeah. No, like when I worked like in the sort of ACU, like I sort of got a feeling for like, oh, it was slightly more accurate than I thought it was going to be, which was nice.
Yeah. Well, and they all use like, you know, physician consultants to tell them their stuff. I think they just sometimes don't care. They're like, yeah. We know it's not realistic, but we like it. So we're going to have Chase do the heart surgery. Right?
Like,
okay,
yeah.
Great.
Yeah. Funny enough, I think there was like that Pixar movie Inside Out, I think was based on like more like science than a lot of these TV shows now.
I know. It's funny. We were just talking about this in my lab, but I actually wrote like an editorial piece on that when it came out. And I was a little bit mad, actually. Like, I think it's a great, obviously, I'm not going to argue it's somebody doing a film where the main character is a female and they're trying to talk about emotions and, you know, they're doing some like solid work and they're doing it in a developmentally appropriate way. So I like all of that, but I really, really didn't like that how they made the brain look. Like we're inside Riley, it was her name, right? We're inside her head the whole time. And we're talking about all of these mind-based things. And there's not a neuron to be seen, right? Like it looks like Candyland, right? So we're inside this little girl's head and everything is pink and purple and sparkly. There's nothing that looks anything like, we know a lot about what the brain looks like. Like make it look cool, make it like a whole thing, but we're so scared of it. Like we can only talk about the brain and we can talk about the mind, but we certainly can't put them together in one girl's head. I don't know. I was annoyed, so I wrote a thing. But anyways, that's my rant about Inside Out.
Yeah, that's nice. That seems like a good place to sort of like cap off the podcast. I guess one last question I sort of had that would tie things up with the bow is what sort of applications do you think your research would have clinically in the future?
Yeah, so the hope is that we would have, I mean, the buzzword is biomarker, right? So we say a biologically based marker of illness or something that we can use for a diagnosis or that we can use to inform a treatment choice, right? So you know, that's the great golden sort of thing that everyone's trying to get to. A lot of people think that's ridiculous and we're never going to get there with psychiatry. I think that we can. I think the brain is a studyable organ. So like a specific example, right? So OCD is one of the most underdiagnosed like disorders that we have in kids. It's actually really tough to diagnose even for subspecialized physicians. So having some sort of an assay that you could do of the brain in really challenging cases that could say, yes, this is what we're, you know, here it's a 95% chance that this is what we're looking at. You should medicate appropriately or treat appropriately. Like that would be really remarkable. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that we're trying to work towards with this crazy movies and the magnet business.
Yeah, it seems like it would definitely help out with diagnosis of things, definitely. I know, especially like with ADHD, for example, there's so much like over and under diagnosing of the condition, right, that it'd be nice to have some sort of like biomarker that we could look at, just like actually have like more quantitative-ish evidence, yeah, that, yeah.
No, of course. And then imagine what would happen to like all of our resource allocation, right? We have really scarce resources for mental health. And that's in part because we aren't equipped to use them efficiently, because it takes us forever to do, you know, I see a kid like six times before I, you know, in lots of cases, before I'm even willing to say, okay, I think we're talking about this. I think this is what's going on, right? If I could just do a test in some cases, and then we know how to treat and we can go forward, you know, I think that that could really change how mental health works and how the resources are getting, you know, divvied up and getting used. And of course, hopefully it just makes it a better experience for the kid.
I think it would also change the perception of psychiatry as well. I know a lot of the times it's sort of just portrayed as like this person in an office with a notepad and the lying down chair. And it's not really thought of as like a science when it, well, it's like, it's medicine.
Yeah. Well, and it will always be both of those things, right? Like mental health is a whole bunch of stuff, just tough stuff about being human and good therapy and childhood business and, you know, all that good stuff. But there's also a lot of it that is, you know, biologically driven, and we need tools in order to play that game, and we just don't have them yet. So yeah, I think it would be remarkably helpful. And it would just, you know, as a doctor, it's just how I would like to be able to do things. And it's what patients would want when they come to see, like, you, if something's wrong, you want to know what it is and you want to know why, and you want to know what to do. It's not rocket science. So it would be really nice if we could get there in increments.
Yeah. I'm definitely looking forward to any sort of reviews you guys are going to have.
Yeah, exactly. Me too. Me too.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a pleasure having you on the podcast. I definitely learned a lot today.
Definitely. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks to you both.
This concludes Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. Again, today's interview was with Dr. Tamara Vanderwall, an assistant professor at UBC's Department of Psychiatry, as well as a clinical researcher and child psychiatrist at BC Children's Hospital. My name is Alirod, and along with my co-host Gurman, we thank you for listening in today, and we hope you tune in again 2 weeks from now for our next interview.